calls the new Hulu series a soap opera on steroids. He says newly uncovered evidence could have changed the entire Alec Murdoch trial. And tonight, South Carolina's most famous attorney, Dick Harpootlian, sits down with STS one-on-one to tell you what really happened inside the Alec Murdoch case and why he believes the system got it wrong.
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, STS Nation? Welcome to Surviving the Survivor. This is the show, the global phenomenon that brings you the best guests in all of true crime. Tonight, we're diving into one of the most infamous criminal cases in American history, at least recent American history, the murders of Maggie and Paul Murdaugh and the stunning downfall of a once untouchable Southern dynasty. Alec Murdoch, once a powerful South Carolina lawyer, he's currently serving two life sentences for those murders, plus 80 years for a maze of financial crimes. But the story appears to be nowhere near over. His defense team, led by the legendary Dick Harpootlian, has now filed their final appellate briefs with the South Carolina Supreme Court, arguing the trial was riddled with jury tampering. You remember Becky Hill, of course, undisclosed evidence, forensic failures, and that clerk of court who now faces misconduct and perjury charges. At the same time, a longtime Murdoch family housekeeper has published or is planning to publish a bombshell memoir claiming she saw troubling details at the crime scene and was never, ever interviewed by authorities. Here he is, a legendary politician, one-time solicitor, and criminal defense attorney, Dick Harpootlian. Great to have you, Dick. Appreciate you being here.
Joel, it's great to be here with you.
Let me start here. How is life, just from a human perspective? It was such an intense few years. All you saw in the headlines were Alec Murdoch, your name, Creighton Waters, both sides of the aisle, other attorneys in South Carolina. It consumed. I've spoken to so many attorneys in South Carolina where it literally consumed their lives, where they were just stopping work to watch this trial. What was that period of time like for you?
Well, I think you've got to put it in perspective. When I got into this case originally, Paul Murdaugh, Alec Murdaugh's father, Randolph Murdaugh, was the solicitor or prosecutor in that part of the state when I was the elected prosecutor or solicitor here in Columbia. So I had known Randolph Murdaugh and his father, Buster Murdaugh, for 50 years. I mean, I knew both of them. We weren't close friends, but we were friends. And so when Paul was charged with the boat case, Randolph indicated to Alec he should call me to represent him. And so I originally got involved and I brought Jim Griffin with me to represent Paul in the boat case, and went down to Moselle, met with him, interviewed him, went through everything. And over the next year or so before the murders, I spent a significant amount of time with Paul, Maggie, and Alec. They'd come here to my office in Columbia. We'd sit in the conference room downstairs and go over some of the issues we're going to confront in the trial and how to deal with them. Jim Griffin went fishing with Paul. I mean, these were, you know, good people. I thought, you know, sometimes good people do bad things, but we had a defense to the boat case, and we were working hard on it when the murders occurred. Jim went down to Moselle and was with Alec during the early times of the investigation. And never in a million years would we think, based on the chemistry I saw between Alec and Paul and Maggie and Alec, I mean, I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now, that he murdered them. They held hands. They expressed love for each other and interest in Paul's welfare. Now, Paul was the apple of Alec's eye. I mean, he hugged on the kid. He, like, when he thought Paul was in trouble, he cried. I mean, he just exhibited all the emotional signs of someone who was deeply in love with his son. And to believe that, and if you watch the trial, you saw in the evidence a videotape of Paul and Alec about an hour and a half before the murders, riding around Moselle looking at a tree that Alec had planted and had fallen over, bent over, and Paul was making fun of him. They were yucking it up. Now, the state's theory, by the way, is that when he thought he was going to be caught that afternoon at 2 o'clock, be caught on some financial misdeed, he decided to distract by going home and executing his wife and child. There's nothing in that video and nothing I ever saw that would indicate to me that Alec Murdaugh would execute his son and wife to distract from his stealing money. I just don't. And that was their whole argument for motive. Without that, there is no motive. And so that year of up until the murders and then afterwards getting prepared. And I got to tell you, I've tried what we would consider in South Carolina major trials in the past as a prosecutor. I'm just having a book coming out on a guy named Donald Pee Wee Gaskins, a mass murderer from the 70s and 80s that I got the electric chair for. That trial took 6 weeks. It was a national story. I defended a death penalty case on court TV 15 years ago. Big deal. I was not ready for social media and the kind of coverage multiple channels provide today. That first day walking up to the courthouse to pick a jury, people sleeping on in sleeping bags on the front lawn of the courthouse waiting to get in. And I remember stopping and asking somebody that was in a sleeping bag, what are you doing here? Where are you from? Oh, I'm from Kansas. Well, you know, you can watch this on TV. Why are you here? I want to be a part of it. And over the next 6 weeks, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. Millions of people watched it. That kind of scrutiny is unheard of. It's something I've been doing this for 50 years. I've never seen anything like it. But I will tell you that that kind of scrutiny helps. I don't know how many emails and calls I've gotten from people since the conviction pointing out things that we didn't even see. So I think it really does help to have that kind of exposure. It was a pressure cooker, no question about it. Again, we disagree with the result. We filed all our appeals. We believe that the Supreme Court will have arguments on that sometime late winter, early spring of next year.
Yeah. So it's obviously a brave new world with social media and the advent of the true crime genre.
Amazing. I mean, again, I've been doing this for half a century. I've never experienced anything like it, nor, you know, and it lets everybody email you, every jerk that's, you know, that doesn't understand the role of attorneys in society. I'll never forget that my favorite email was from some guy who emailed, how can you represent that murderous scumbag? I hope you die of ass cancer. Now, I mean, really? What's that? What's wrong with that guy? I mean, he needs to turn his TV off and go out for a hike or something.
Yeah, there's I have a lot of issue. I agree with you on that. And trust me, I'm on the receiving end of a lot of negative emails. And you got to, you know, I know you have this, but I'm speaking more to myself right now. You've got to grow a thick skin, especially now. I was in broadcast news. This will be, if I stayed in, this would have been 2026, my 30th year. Wow. And I never received email in the form, and I'm on X, Twitter, all those things. But the way people agree to disagree is not the way they used to. And people just become very volatile. So, I mean, that's a whole separate issue, but I'm sorry you were getting those emails, but I can't say that I'm surprised by it at all. But let me just, first of all, you have a book that has nothing really to do with Alec Murdaugh that's coming out, or is out, I believe, called Dig Me a Grave. Yep. What is the book about? You gave us a hint, Pee Wee Gaskins. Who was this guy? And why did you decide, you know, I assumed it was going to be a book about Alec Murdaugh, but in fact, it is not. What is Dig Me a Grave?
So Dig Me a Grave is about a guy named Donald Pee Wee Gaskins. It's called Pee Wee because he's about 5'2". when I met Gaskins in 1982, he was being charged with the execution murder, smuggling in a quarter of a pound of C4 explosive in a blasty cap, and on a contract hit, blowing the head off a death row inmate in the most secure wing of the most secure prison in South Carolina. That was his 14th murder. He had murdered pregnant women, 2-year-old children. I mean, he had a horrendous record of killing in the mid-19 and late 1970s. Gaskins was unique in a number of different ways. Not only was this the largest number of people killed by one person in South Carolina ever, but he was affable. He was, prosecuted literally dozens, if not 100 murder cases and many other serious cases. I'd never had a defendant refer to me by my first name. When he walked in the courtroom for his bond hearing, he looked at me and waved. He said, "Hey, Dick, how you doing?" And of course, your immediate response is, I'm Southern, you know, "Hey, Pee Wee, how you doing?" Throughout the trial, and even after the trial, it was Dick and Pee Wee. And as recounted in the book, he sort of got in, not sort of, he did get in my head. We're sitting at a break, lunch break during the trial, and he had conned the guards into letting him eat his lunch in the courtroom, not in the holding cell, down in the holding cell. So he's sitting there eating his lunch. He's got three guards around him. I'm over at prosecution table prepping for the afternoon. And I hear Pee-wee in a high-pitched voice, "Dick, Dick." I said, "Yeah, Pee-wee, what do you want?" He said, "You know, you're a lot like me." I said, "What the hell are you talking about?" He said, "You like killing." I said, "No, I don't. What are you talking about?" He said, "You like killing me?" I said, no, "I'm doing justice." And he said, no, "You're enjoying killing me." And he said, "You know, justice in the prison where I spent most of my life, justice, your view of justice depends on whether you're giving it or getting it," sort of a sexual allusion there. He laughed. And then the last thing he said to me was, "Yeah, you like killing." So as I go through, and look, I prosecuted a number of death penalty cases and defended some. I'd always had questions about the efficacy of the death penalty I was doing my job. I took an oath to do my job. In his case, because I did get to know him, but then counterbalancing that are the 13 other murders and this one, which he did basically, I say contract, he didn't get paid for it. A black man named Tyner had killed two white folks in a robbery of a store named The Moon. And Pete had been sentenced to death, but their son, Tony Simo, had gotten impatient, wanted it over with, and arranged for Pee Wee to kill him. And Pee Wee did kill him. And of course, when we prosecuted Pee Wee for that, he tried to get other people to take it. He had all kinds of, you'll have to read the book, but all kinds of moves trying to deflect the blame. And he was always sentenced to the electric chair. 2 weeks before his execution, he tried to have his son kidnap my 4-year-old daughter and hold her hostage. I mean, he orchestrated all this from death row. Guy was evil. He was conniving. He was a brilliant tactician, if you will. He always knew where the buttons were.
How old is your daughter today?
My daughter turned 38 yesterday.
Wow. And I assume she was too young at the time to understand this. What'd she say about that today at 38?
Well, she says she remembers. I mean, when we found out about the plot, immediately the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division sent a number of people to guard me and my family. She can remember, and she'll tell you, getting up and going downstairs and seeing these men with machine guns, and it was, and when we took her to school, she had an escort of, again, men with guns everywhere, looking everywhere. She remembers it. She remembers that general, what are these strange men doing in the house with machine guns? But she has no, I don't think she ever appreciated the threat. Today, she understands how close she came to being Pee-wee's victim number 15, because Pee-wee had told his son, "Hold her hostage, put her in the trunk of a car, call Solicitor Harper," and I was elected DA, solicitor at that point, "tell him to have me brought up to the courthouse to meet with him in his office." And they would have done that. They would have put him in the office. And I would say, I'm fine. Let me talk to him alone. And he knew I had a door. Nobody knew this, a door, a back door where he could escape. I mean, the fact that he knew that is frightening. But the kid said to his dad, he put this in his written statement, what if Harputlian won't do that? And he said, kill her. So, but for the grace of God and one of the people he talked to about it going to the sheriff, we could have been confronted with just a horrible, horrible situation.
Wow. The book is Dig Me a Grave. By the way, for the record, off camera, I referred to him as Mr. Harputlian and asked him if he preferred Mr. or Dick. And he told me Dick. So I was not like Pee Wee Gaskins for the record. But in the book, you ask aloud in the book to yourself, essentially like a self reflective question. Am I a killer too? What was your, I guess, final takeaway for yourself after writing this book? And, you know, he called you a killer, but you say that you are, you know, meeting out justice. I tend to agree with you, obviously. But what was your own takeaway from your experience writing this?
You know, I think, and, you know, when I say I'm not deeply religious, but I do, you know, believe in the tenets of Jesus Christ. And I think killing is wrong. Unless, and still in the book, I talked to my father about it, who was a bomber pilot in World War II, where they killed thousands and thousands and thousands of people in self-defense. Mm-hmm. I think the death penalty is appropriate when it is an act of self-defense. And in Pee-wee's case, a guy serving 13 life sentences, which could have been death penalty, and then takes it upon himself for basically his own amusement to kill a black guy on death row because he was very racist. There's no, if not him, who? And how do you stop somebody who's in prison for life and they kill again? I've resolved that I may very well be a killer, but I believe we're killing in self-defense. And I think that is something that you can accept. And I don't think it's a morally reprehensible act, like his acts. I'm not his equivalent. I resolve that. I do regret the death of anybody. And I think that's what our religion teaches us. I regret it, but sometimes it's a necessary act. And Pee-wee was a necessary act.
Yeah. I like to ask weird questions, and this just popped in my head. I mean, you're obviously one of the best at what you do. You're also heavily involved in politics. But if you were never a solicitor, never a criminal defense attorney, never in politics, what do you think you would have done with your life? Was this something that you knew from age five? Hey, I'm going to be the best criminal defense attorney and solicitor in the state of South Carolina? Or did you have other aspirations?
You know, when I was in college, and this is the late 60s, before you were born, I'm sure. But society was going through tumult sort of like today, in the sense that the Vietnam War was boiling and racial discrimination. And, you know, I became not radicalized, but I grew up in a segregated South. I went to an all white high school. Restaurants would not serve black people. I mean, that was something we accepted. And I didn't really know didn't appreciate it as it being wrong. But as I went to college and began seeing reality and appreciating the fact that discrimination was wrong and questioned the war. I can remember I went to Clemson, which is 2 hours up the road from Atlanta. I went down with some friends of mine to Martin Luther King's funeral in April of 68, saw Bobby Kennedy there, saw all kinds of people. And I felt this tremendous sadness. And at the same time, what can we do to move forward as one country? And so my politics became, I guess you would say, they're liberal, against the war, pro civil rights back in that era. And when I got to law school, I worked on an underground newspaper here in Columbia and met a young guy who was running against the 20-year incumbent DA, who just thought the system was corrupt. And we, the newspapers for him, I supported him, and he won and he offered me a job. And I said, look, I mean, I had hair down to my shoulders. I might have dabbled occasionally in smoking something, but yeah, I smoked a lot of weed. Let's just put it that way. And I didn't want to. I said, hey, man, I don't want to be a pig. I don't want to prosecute. I want to change the system. He said, well, you can change it from the inside much quicker than the outside. So I took a job with him, got my hair cut. got off drugs. I mean, I wasn't addicted to drugs, but, you know, obviously you can't prosecute somebody for drugs and at the same time be doing them. And I can remember my first trial in January 1975. I'd never been in a courtroom, and it was an armed robbery trial, and an older prosecutor was supposed to sit with me. And he said, "Well, you go make the opening statement," which I did. I got up and introduced myself, read the indictment, and I said, "I'll be assisting." And he'd left. So my indoctrination in the trial law was hit or miss. Judge chewed my ass out every 15 minutes because they didn't know what I was doing. But I got a conviction. And what I really liked was the ability to explain to 12 ordinary citizens the law and the facts in the case. I fell instantly in love. And with the process, I tried 60 cases that year, back when you could try a DUI second or third or fourth and two a day. I prosecuted my first death penalty case. It's in the book, in August of that year. Picked a jury Monday morning at 10 o'clock. He sentenced to death at 2 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon. Now, after Furman versus Georgia, the U.S. Supreme Court case striking down that process, he got a life sentence. But he was sentenced to death by the jury in basically one day. But as I did more of it, I really, really, really enjoyed. Look, as a prosecutor, your job is not to get a conviction. Your job is to see that justice is done. And if you can divorce yourself from "I won, how many did I win," to making sure that you've got the evidence to convince a jury, and you're convinced beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant's guilty, this becomes a process where you put your head down on the pillow every night and sleep soundly. And I enjoyed doing that. When I left the DA's office after 8 years and went out into private practice, began doing civil cases, I found those same skills, cross-examination, examination, were very, very useful in a civil courtroom. And so over the years, I've done prosecution, defense, civil plaintiffs cases. I've recovered almost $500 million from my clients on the civil side, but it's the same set of skills. And look, I get up every morning wanting to go to work, wanting to do this job.
That's I think that's key. That was my next question. I promise we're digging into Alec Murdoch and all the things that Dick said off the top. Relax. We're just building it up here. And I find the human part of this. Look, I one of the issues with social media and the media, they quickly portray people. The last thing I had on my bingo card is that Dick Harpootlian was a quasi hippie, as my parents were, smoking weed. But that's what a lot of people did in the 60s. So already we're seeing a different side of Dick Harpootlian. And it seems like a pretty cool and interesting guy. My question to you is, besides the passion, what is, in your opinion, what's the singular most important attribute to be a great attorney? What is the most important attribute?
Integrity. I mean, look, the rule of law, you can cheat and win. You know, this is like golf, where, you know, you can cheat, not get caught, and win. You can move your ball. You can do those sorts of things. If you're a prosecutor, you can cheat by not giving the other side evidence that would damage your case. If you're a defense attorney, you can cheat by giving your defendant a better story than he has, help him plug up the holes so that when he takes the stand, his story is solid. You can cheat. You can hide evidence. You can do all those sorts of things. But if you don't do that, then there's the satisfaction that you dispensed as a prosecutor, dispensed justice, and as a defense attorney, that you did your job with integrity and honesty. And that's what the rule of law is all about. And I think sometimes today, especially in the comments I got during the Murdoch trial, or Murdoch, whichever way you want to say it, were by people that don't understand this wonderful constitutional system we have that's unique in the world, that allows 12 men and women from ordinary walks of life to make decisions about somebody's guilt or innocence and the law, which is generated, you know, by our Supreme Court of courts, and fashioned in a way that makes sure that the accused gets the benefit of the doubt, every reasonable doubt. And I mean, I can't say enough. I talk to young prosecutors, young lawyers all the time. It takes a lot of work to do that, to make that happen. And if you're not willing to work as a trial lawyer Saturdays and Sundays and nights, don't do it. Go, you know, go be a tax lawyer somewhere.
That's amazing advice. And by the way, I don't want to sound like a curmudgeon-y old man myself, but I feel like a lot of work ethic type traits are out the window, especially with the instant wealth that's out there now. But yeah, at the end of the day, I always tell my kids, if you outwork the other students, you're going to likely do better than they are. By the way, I'm so glad you brought up the pronunciation. I have a friend who emailed me. He's like, do not call him Alec Murdoch. That's incorrect. Just call him Alex. What is the correct pronunciation? How do you pronounce his name?
Well, I mean, when I'm in a courtroom in the lower in Walterboro, it's Murdoch. Okay. And it's Murdoch. Alec yeah. Murdoch or Alec Alex Murdoch. Sometimes. It just depends. But it's Murdoch. It's not Murdaugh. It's Murdoch. It can be even Murdoch. If you spend a lot of time in the low country, you'll find they don't talk quite like the rest of us. And so they will abbreviate pronunciation of a syllable we would elongate. And it's when you're in front of a Colleton County jury, though, it's Murdoch. It's not Murdoch.
There we go. We're learning a lot today. The pronunciation, I'll go the Alec Murdoch then. Let's dig into some of the particulars. You mentioned this off the top, and I'm just referring to a couple of notes I took here. The boat crash, of course, Mallory Beach, the victim in this. Paul ends up getting charged. Of course, that's Alex's son who ends up murdered. But he's charged with boating under the influence, causing death and great bodily harm. The Beach family eventually files a wrongful death suit. Now, I believe you were quoted as saying that you thought that Paul was innocent of these charges. Do you still feel that way? This in a lot of ways, some people, I think, including you, believe that maybe was a catalyst to the murders eventually. So let's start with the boat accident. I mean, do you think that Paul was responsible for this?
Well, here, let's look at the boat accident under the standard of they have to prove him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt rather than him having to prove himself innocent. Mm-hmm. There are two statements well known during the process of that boat ride that night. Paul was not behind the wheel much of the time. The question is, was he behind the wheel at the time of the crash? And we know one of the girls yells out, look out, not Paul's name. I don't want to point fingers at anybody in this context. I would have in a trial. Look out, so-and-so, right half a second before they hit the bridge. So, I mean, that, and there's other corroborating evidence that would indicate that he, that his placement where he was in the boat at the time of the wreck was not behind the wheel. And whoever was behind the wheel would have suffered significant facial injuries or other injuries. And there is somebody else in the boat whose name was being yelled out that suffered those injuries. So, again, can we prove who was behind the wheel? No. Can the prosecution show beyond a reasonable doubt it was Paul? No.
Yeah.
And by the way, those civil suits, it's preponderance of the evidence. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. So could he be found civilly liable and yet not criminally liable? Absolutely. Happens all the time.
Yeah. You know, obviously there's attorney-client privilege, but I mean, prior to his death, did you ever have an open conversation with Paul or Alec? I mean, did they ever tell you one way or the other? Yes, it was me. No, it was me. I don't know what part of that you can share.
I'd love to share that with you. But as you point out, there's attorney-client privilege, and I would never reveal discussions by a client with me.
Yeah. Yes. And I appreciate that very much. And that goes back to the integrity. But I have to ask it, I guess. In the same vein, so Alec has been behind bars now for a while. Do you keep in fairly close touch with him from prison?
We basically talk once a week by telephone. He's in a remote prison, which takes about 2.5 hours to get to. And then getting in to see him is about an hour long, 45 minute to hour long process. So, you know, it is a huge undertaking to go see him in person. We have done that, but 80%, 85% of the time it's phone calls.
Yeah. And I mean, can you tell us kind of his state of mind right now? You know, how's he handling prison? A lot of people are going to yell at me even for asking that, because they're going to say, we don't care. He deserves to be there. I'm just curious about his state of mind. Right.
I think he's very positive. I think he's read copies. He's a lawyer, so he's read copies of the briefs. He is cautiously optimistic, as we are, that he'll get a new trial. There's no guarantees, but we think there's a record that would allow this Supreme Court to give him a new trial.
And from the trial and the whole, you know, the whole umbrella from boat crash through verdict of the actual Alec Murdoch trial, in your opinion, what was the single biggest misconception that the public had about this entire case?
Well, I think let me see if I can put this in pretty succinct, simple terms. The fact that the first 2.5 weeks of the trial focused on his financial misdeeds, which he pled guilty to after the trial, if you remember correctly. Mm-hmm. He never contested those, even at the trial. He stole the money, $10, $12 million, no question about it, from vulnerable people, orphans, paraplegics, horrible. And he is a horrible person for doing that.
Do we know why he did that? I mean, was it, everyone speculates that it was a serious drug issue. Can that be corroborated?
He had a serious drug issue. I talked to his doctor after he was in rehab. And we have checks written to drug dealers in the millions. That's probably part of it. He may have had some financial investments in 08 that went south like everybody else. I mean, there's no real way to figure it out. The end of the day, the money was stolen and he admits that. And he has pled guilty and gotten 40 years in the penitentiary for it. But by the time they got, first of all, we don't believe, and we objected then on our appeal saying, if the rationale for allowing that evidence in was to show motive, that is, their motive was the jig was up. He's going to be on his financial misdeeds were going to be uncovered immediately. And he killed his wife and child to distract from that. They said that's what they said. And by the way, in final argument, they looked at the jury with a straight face and said, yeah, you know, you really don't need to consider motive because it's absurd. Excuse me. But I think what is important is to understand by the time we got to talk about forensics, fingerprints, DNA, cell phone records, GPS records, all the things that showed that he could not have committed the murder, we lost him. We lost the jury right then. The second piece of that is the jury was being influenced by the Cork Accord. So she's on one hand fixing the jury. On the other hand, while the prosecution, and this is their job, I disagree with the judge's rulings, but, you know, he was being just overwhelmed with this horrible evidence. And she's saying to them, you know, don't believe him. Don't watch the way he testifies. He's good. He's going to con you, whatever. And then later on, we find out she's telling people she needs a guilty verdict to sell this book she's writing so she can buy a lake house. I mean, that's uncontradicted testimony. So
where does that case stand now with Becky? This he's talking about.
She's
Becky
never been
Hill,
charged with any impropriety based on the Murdoch trial. Some other improprieties about finances in her office. But remember this now, the attorney general, the chief prosecutor referred to her as Becky Boo. They were best buddies during this trial. And I'm not accusing him of anything except all these allegations of attempting to obstruct justice have never been investigated by the attorney general's office. We found those jurors. We got out in my car and drove around the dirt roads of Carlton County interviewing jurors who corroborated that she was talking to them about the case, which is a black and white hard line. You don't do violation that gets you a new trial based on federal law.
Mm-hmm. I thought I had read, and maybe I misread this, that there was going to be some sort of appeal as well of the financial crimes, but you're saying that he opened up no appeal. No. Okay. So I mean, either way, whether there's a new murder trial or not, he's in there for the financial crimes for the better part of 40 years, which essentially for a guy his age could be a life sentence. Could correct? Be.
What's important in Alex's mind or Alex's mind and ours is that the truth come out. Somebody committed these murders. And on the night, and I think we argued this and showed forensically on the night of the murders, the police that showed up saw a guy standing there with a shotgun, which he on the 911 tape said, I'm going to get a shotgun killer. May still be here. They pull up. He's got a shotgun. Wife and child are dead. I mean, this is domestic violence 101. He immediately becomes a suspect. Do they take DNA or dust, not dust, or however they, with fingerprints now, from the feed room where Paul's head was blown off? No. There's a photograph of a footprint right next to his feet. And when I say bloody, there's blood and brains and there's a footprint in it. Later identified as one of the sheriff deputies. I mean, the integrity of the crime scene, there was no integrity. They didn't close off. People were walking through the blood. People were moving stuff. They're not checking. The chief, fire chief who showed up said their tire tracks coming and going from this back entrance to the dog pens. How about let's preserve those until somebody can get pictures or casts of them. Every cop coming in ran over it. It was destroyed in 5 minutes, he testified. There was tissue under Maggie's fingernails. They've never identified, either excluded Alec or included. They just say they didn't have the ability to test it.
So there was no DNA testing of the matter that was under Maggie's fingertips.
Well, they say there wasn't enough material to test, but we had experts that said there was. I mean, all kinds of missed, opportunities because, again, he did it. They decided that within minutes of pulling up and seeing him there. That's number one. Number two, they took his shirt, had it processed, and one of the sweat agents announced or leaked to the press that it was Paul's blood spatter on that shirt. And until Thanksgiving, we tried this, drew a jury on January 23rd of 23, but right after Thanksgiving of 22, basically less than 60 days earlier, we, a paralegal in my office, found a forensic report about that T-shirt in misfiled in some witness statement, which said it wasn't human blood. So for a year and a half, they've been touting this everywhere. The agent testified he told the grand jury that when they got an indictment. I mean, it was just Keystone Cops. And by the way, their expert and our expert agree that whoever killed Paul shot him buckshot in the chest, came out under his arm. The second shot is a shotgun probably pressed to the top of his skull, which exploded his skull. His brain hit the ceiling of the feed room and fell at his feet. Whoever did that would have blood and brains embedded in their eyes, in their hair, in their clothes. 45 minutes after they say that he shot and killed Paul, he's in his vehicle driving over to see his mom. There's no blood or brains on the golf cart that he rode down there. There's no blood or brains in his car. They checked that night. They checked the showers. They looked for clothes. And by the way, that night they pretty well insisted that shirt with the blood spatter on it, which was not human blood. It was fish. But that night they said, oh, we got him. We got blood spatter on here. So, I mean, it was a terrible investigation with a whole lot of questions left. So,
yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I have three young children. I have a 6-year-old son. And the way you were talking about Alec and Paul is how I see myself with my, you know, I dote on my son. I'm taking him to soccer practice. I'm taking him to T-ball practice. Sadly in this country, and I'm not saying it's okay, but we see all the time, we see spouses killing one another, but to take it to the level of murdering your own son, which is what he's convicted of, to me, that is unconscionable. It does give me, if I'm being completely transparent, a moment for pause to say, is that, you know, did this guy potentially just lose his mind and snap over the pressure? And we all know money creates a lot of pressure. But a lot of people have said to me, that seems like a bridge too far. Is it maybe killing Maggie? Sadly, again, that's something that through the lens of society happens all too often. But when I put myself in those shoes and I think, well, could I take my son's life? There's nothing on earth, I think. And everyone, look, I've spoken to a lot of homicide detectives who say exactly what you said at the beginning. A lot of good people do a lot of bad things. And if the circumstances all come to a boil, you never know. But that I have, when I think of it, that's where it is very difficult for me. But this all begs the question, if Alec didn't do it, who do you think murdered Maggie and Paul? I mean, I know you say you're looking for the killers, but do you have a thought about who could have done this and why?
I do, but I don't want to play that card until we get a new trial where I can explore that without tipping anybody about where we're going. So, yes, we have a theory, and the theory is supported by some of the evidence and some of the statements. So, again, the police, the SLED investigating officers made a decision and ignored, in my opinion, any other lead that came their way. And we have pursued some of those leads, and some of them, I think, will prove very fruitful in a retrial.
I think publicly you've alluded, or at least the media has alluded for you, to the fact that you believe it could be either retaliation for the boat crash or something related to, you know, drug runners because of Alex's drug issue. Am I close there on either?
You're warm.
Point? I'm warm. Okay. Well, getting warm. Okay. I'll hold off for right now. Now your rival here, of course, is the guitar playing prosecutor, Creighton Waters. I don't think there was any love lost at the time, but now with some time having passed, your thoughts on the job he did, and are you guys, when you see each other in the hall, do you give each other a nod, hello, or is the tension?
Look, I talked about the Gaskins case earlier. Jack Swirling was the lawyer that represented Gaskins. I prosecuted him. 6 months after the Gaskins trial, we went into practice with each other. I mean, this is not, if you have to hate your opponent, you shouldn't be in this job. Creighton Waters and I knew each other well before the trial. I have great respect for him. I think he does a very good job. He's very efficient and very strategic. He behaved very well during this trial. I see him all the time at bar functions and whatever. We converse, yuck it up a little bit. He I'm sure will be voracious in his argument before the Supreme Court on this case. And we hope to do an aggressive job too. I mean, I think people confuse, especially people that don't understand how the system works, a lawyer with being more than an advocate for his client. You know, they forget Lincoln defended 20 murder cases. John Adams represented the soldiers in the Boston Massacre and got three of them acquitted and two of them reduced sentences. I mean, the second president of the United States. So they understood, this country generally understands, but people seem to believe if you represent somebody, somehow you've adopted them or adopt, whether you're prosecuting or defending, as a prosecutor, you have a job to do. You took an oath. I took the same oath to be a prosecutor and a defense attorney to see that justice is done. So no, Creighton and I, are we bowl together? No, but I occasionally catch a clip of him playing his guitar somewhere. He's they're not bad. I mean, would I pay money to see him? No, but I think they're pretty damn good.
Do you bowl? Are you a bowler?
No.
Okay. Are you a golfer?
I was a golfer till the pandemic, and then once it shut down, and then I got COVID, and then quickly shifted into Murdaugh. I mean, it was just wasn't enough time.
Yeah.
I want to start playing again, but
That's just not enough time in the day.
You know,
do you think that the, you know, I, please don't take this the wrong way, but I think one of the issues you face too, if I'm being completely transparent, I think the media really portrayed, leaving Alec aside, I feel like they portrayed the defense team as sort of this old Southern boys club, curmudgeon-y Dick Harpootlian versus a young, hip, guitar-playing Creighton Waters. And I'm wondering if you think that that impacted the court of public opinion as well. Obviously, talking to you, you're a really nice guy. I did not expect you to say that you were sort of a hippie-ish guy smoking weed in the night, but you don't know till you interview people. So the public has this perception of you. Did that hurt the case?
I mean, I don't think so in Carlton, South Carolina, and Walterboro, South Carolina. Absolutely not. Now, if I was trying this case in California, I have a case out in California right now, and I referred to a woman lawyer on the other side of the room as young lady. Holy crap. I mean, cancel my ass on the spot. And I mean, in my upbringing, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, young lady, yes, ma'am. I mean, those are common. And in Walterboro, South Carolina, people expect that. So, you know, I am a product of my environment. Now, you know, if somebody watching the trial from Miami thought I was curmudgeonly or old or whatever, I get that. But they shouldn't, because I'm not. I am proud of my record as a trial lawyer, and I'm as good today. I think I'm better today than I was 25 years ago.
Yeah, I think you get better with age, like wine, a lot of people, and you're obviously very cogent and coherent and with it. My mother is 86. She's my co-host sometimes, and she's a lot sharper than I am. But, you know, you mentioned some blood evidence, and, you know, as difficult as it is to hear some of the, you know, blood and brain spatter, but is there like kind of a singular piece of evidence or context that you wish the, not only the viewers, but more importantly, the jurors had seen before forming an opinion that you feel would have changed the course?
Well, yes, there is a key piece of evidence that the judge allowed in, but then allowed the prosecution, we believe, inappropriately to challenge. On the night of the murders, somebody threw Maggie's phone on the side of the road about a half a mile from Moselle. And it's sort of an interesting twist. We knew what time it hit the ground, our expert said, because if you look at this cell phone right here, when you, as I just did, I picked it up, it comes on. So it will go off, and then if it's thrown, it's going to come on. And then when it comes to rest, it will go off. So you can tell when it hit the ground a half a mile away. We had an estimation of what time Alec left Moselle to go see his mother, and he would drive right by that spot. During the trial, it was testified that by the local FBI folks, that they could not get access to the data in the black box on Alex's car, which would give them GPS, start times, all those things, and end times, when he turned it on, when he turned it off, where he drove. And apparently someone's wife at GMC saw that testimony, watching it, called her husband and said, "What the hell? Why aren't you cooperating with the FBI?" The next day, we get that information in the middle of the trial. So we now know, when we get that, when Alec cranked the car to go to Moselle, go to his mom's house. And what we can tell you is that within 10 seconds of that phone hitting the ground, 10 seconds later, Alec is cranking his car half a mile away. He could not have thrown it. Now, I mean, that the state wasn't ready for that, because they didn't know, and we weren't. We were ready with estimations, but that nailed it down to the second. So they had a cop, not a forensic expert, sit in an office over the weekend and throw the phone to see how many times it came on and didn't come on. He didn't even keep a record of how many times it came on and so-called didn't. no video, no, and he wasn't an expert. And he testified it didn't come on every time. That's basically, he got, we objected. There's evidence standards called Daubert in federal court. What qualifies as expert testimony. And the judge let it in, which again gave the jury a reason, if they wanted to disbelieve it. We think that'll get, we think that we got a strong argument that should be reversed on appeal, and that evidence should have been allowed without. Of course, in a retrial, they can go find an, if they can find an expert that says what our expert says is not true, have at it. Our guy is an expert in Apple phones. They had some sheriff deputy throwing it up against the wall.
Hypothetically, if Alec was to get a new trial, like, are you ready to go essentially right now? I mean, would you need a lot of time to prepare?
We need a lot of time to prepare. Well, I'd like to, you know, we have to go back. There's a couple things. One, you'd want to go back and read and mark up everybody's testimony. So when they call them this time, you'd be better prepared to cross them. And you can impeach them if they change their testimony. We spent about $600,000 on costs in the case. Basically everything we got paid for a fee and expenses. It would be necessary for us to see if the family, or we could raise money some other way to fund that. And that's not going to happen overnight. So could we do it immediately? We could do it within a year, maybe even shorter once we got our arms around it. And we have to see what the Supreme Court says. Why are they reversing it? What evidence would not come in again? I mean, that's an analysis will take a little time. But yeah, we could go pretty quickly.
Yeah, I apologize. I should have asked this, and I made it a point. I completely forgot much earlier on. How is Buster doing? Obviously, he's a real victim.
He's married to Brooklyn, and they're doing well. He's working. She's working. She's a lawyer, practicing law. They're doing great.
Okay, good. I'm happy to hear that. Obviously, it's got to be, you know, just a seismic level of devastation that he is dealing with, and to come back from that, kudos to him if he's getting his life together and moving forward. And STS sending out their thoughts to Buster Murdoch. You know, there was this theory about two shooters. You still, you know, it's different angles on those shotgun blasts. Is that something also that you know, you would continue to explore if there was the potential for a second trial?
It seems, I mean, you've got two different weapons being used.
Sounds like New York City there.
Yeah, should I wait to respond?
No, you're okay. Good. You can go.
So it's sort of incredible that one shooter would gun down Paul and then immediately pick up the AR and gun down Maggie. And remember now, whoever shot Maggie not only just shot her, but she got a kill shot in the head, the back of the head, after she's on the ground. So this is somebody, I mean, are they wanting to make sure she's not a witness? I mean, it's just it would appear there were two shooters. Again, if Sweat had taken the time to seal the scene, you could have figured that out. But it had been walked over so many times by the time they did process the scene, you didn't know which shoe imprints were cops and which were perps. So, opportunity missed.
And now there's a few more things I just have to get to, and I appreciate Dick taking, you know, an hour of his time today, which I would not be able to afford his billable hour. So I appreciate him doing this. But one of the most lingering questions still is, you know, the people ask themselves is, why did Maggie go to Moselle that night? Why do you think she went? Apparently, you know, according to reports, that she was becoming somewhat suspicious of activity. Do you have a reason as to why she was at Moselle?
Well, because Paul was going to be at Moselle. I mean, if you looked at the text messages, there's nothing suspicious about him. And she was at the beach, and she would come home to Moselle. I mean, there's no secret. She wasn't in love with being at Moselle. She preferred to be up at Edisto. But Paul was going to be there, and she was going to come home and have dinner with them. And After dinner, she went down to a little workshop she has near the dog sheds, and Paul went down there with her. Alec did not. So if, again, the fact he didn't go down, and but he did come down later, there's no question about that, and made jokes about the dog having either a chicken or a guinea that it had grabbed, their dog. So, I mean, again, the mood at that point is pretty light. It's hard to believe, it's impossible to believe that within 5 minutes he's blowing Paul's head off and gunning her down. It's just, again, it's incredulous, no motive. The forensics don't support their position, but it was the easy way to go.
Yeah. And I completely understand and respect the fact that you can't, you know, compromise the integrity of attorney client privilege. Can I just ask, when you have private conversations with Alec, is he adamant that this was not him?
Adamant just, you know, would be an understatement. He did okay. not kill, as he said during his sentencing, he did okay. not kill them. He has consistently said that from day one.
Yeah. So there's another kind of new facet to all of this as well. These are newly revealed text messages between Alec and Curtis, Eddie Smith, and he was represented at least one time by Amy Zimmercheck, who we've had on the show. You were quoted as saying that these text messages would have changed your trial strategy. Tell us about these text messages and why it would have changed your strategy overall.
I've said that in general terms. I don't think I want to go into details with the chance that we may get Eddie to testify in trial number two. So suffice it to say, I think that would have had an impact. I don't want to go into details, though.
Was it like a Brady issue? Is there a reason that they weren't disclosed prior to the first trial?
We're not sure. Look, we got 3 million documents dumped on us. We don't believe we saw them, but we'll have to scrub that to make sure we didn't see them. And again, a number of them were misfiled. I mean, we found the blood spatter analysis of no human blood in a witness statement. I don't think they did that intentionally. I think this case demonstrates incompetence on the part of law enforcement from beginning to end.
Yeah, and you just said 3 million docs. I don't think people realize the voluminous nature of that. I mean, how during the trial, you know, leading up to the trial and during the trial, I know you and Jim Griffin were like renting a home. I mean, how many hours a day were you working this case during trial?
During the trial? Yeah. Well, you know, we rented a wedding venue about 10 minutes from the courthouse, and it had six separate houses, a main house, which had a full kitchen and a big open dining room. And we hired a cook, not a chef, a cook. Okay. You know, meat and potatoes kind of cook, okra, collards, those kinds of things. There was no souffles. And we would, we'd come Sunday night, she'd have a meal ready. We'd get prepared for Monday. I typically get up about 4:30. We'd work till probably 10 o'clock, get up at 4:30 or 5 the next morning, start working again, have breakfast, get everything ready for that day, you know, get showered, shave, be at the courthouse 10 minutes early, try until about 1 o'clock. And then a good friend of mine, Margie Matthews, who was in the state Senate with me and a senator from down there, her law office is right behind the courthouse. We'd have lunch brought in there, work over lunch. And then when we broke at 5:30 or 6, we'd go back to our wedding venue, which was called Eden. If ever place was misnamed, that was it. We would have dinner and review everything, pull documents for the next day. We had 5 different computers set up in that room so we could draw documents. And by the way, when you have that many documents down given to you, you don't keep them in boxes. You put them in a database, which you can search, and you know, are categorized. So if you need John Smith's statement, or anytime John Smith was mentioned in a statement, you can search it and it pops up. Those things are not inexpensive to maintain because you have to rent the space from some company that provides it. But it's a lifesaver. And so we do that till probably 9:30 or 10, go to bed, get up 4:35 next morning, do that through Friday, and then head home to Colombia, where we were from. My wife at the time was the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Slovenia. So when I got home on Friday night and Saturday, I'm washing my own clothes. You know what I mean? And ordering in because I didn't want to buy groceries for, you know, the weekend. And maybe get a nap on Saturday afternoon if I was lucky. And then, you know, work, getting ready, getting all this, anything I needed. I did have a law practice at that time. So I'd come down to the office on Saturday or Sunday morning and then head back there Sunday afternoon. Did that for 6 weeks. The Gaskins case I mentioned took just under 6 weeks. So the two longest criminal trials in the history of the state, I did both of them 40 years apart.
Wow. Real quickly. So, Maggie's longtime housekeeper, Blanca Simpson, she's published a memoir saying that she saw troubling inconsistencies at Moselle that were never pursued by investigators, which is, you've said the same thing, that investigators didn't do enough. She is suggesting Alec did not act alone. She talks about scene anomalies, the clothes laid out wrong, the towel placement, car parked incorrectly. What do you make of her comments about this?
I think just like Becky Hill, she's trying to sell a book. I look forward, should we get a new trial, for her testifying under oath is all I can say.
Real quick, I've got some viewer questions and we always bring in our community. This will be rapid fire. I'll just read you a question, give you a quick answer. This first one here, a lot of viewers, and I forgot the name, so I apologize. This is a direct quote here in the question. A lot of viewers watched every minute of the trial and believe Alec did not get a fair shake. One viewer told us his 911 call sounded real and the voice ID evidence felt like junk science. What was the most difficult or unexpected challenge in representing someone the public openly hates?
Well, I mean, the problem is when you're representing somebody with so much public exposure during the trial, people are going to talk. They're going to get their take on the facts and tell it to somebody who tells it to somebody who tells it to somebody. And everybody, even jurors, I think, can't be insulated from that kind of talk. Judges, jurors, lawyers, it impacts the entire process. I think if we do it again, we'd want the jury sequestered.
Yeah. Interesting. Dick, what is it like defending a client, especially an attorney? I always hear that that's a nightmare for attorneys, who tries to control the narrative, wants to testify, and tends to micromanage his own case. Did Alec listen to your advice or did he push back a lot?
Well, that would violate attorney client, but I will say Alec is an attorney or was an attorney, was a very good attorney. But that doesn't mean he adopted every piece of advice we gave him. Because he is an attorney, he has tried cases. He understands and understood the pluses and the minuses, but I can't give you details.
If Alec Murdoch didn't kill Maggie and Paul, why wasn't he able to give investigators a clean, consistent story from the start?
Well, I mean, the initial story was he hadn't been down to, the only thing he contradicted himself on was having been down to the dog pens that night. And he explained on the stand. And I think, truthfully says that when the cop showed up, they thought he did it. And clearly, if you look at it, they thought he did it. They were treating him like, not like a victim, but like a suspect. He had drugs in his pocket, Oxycontin, oxycodone. He was on Oxycontin, oxycodone, paranoid, and he didn't want to put himself anywhere near the scene of the crime by his own admission. And so he conceded, he lied to them. But again, he was traumatized by finding his wife and child on drugs, holding drugs when they put him in the car.
I watched the entire Alec Murdoch trial and honestly believe, you're going to like this one, Dick. I watched the entire Alec Murdoch trial and honestly believe he is innocent. His 911 call was too real. Most guilty people are setting up their alibi in that call. Also, the voice evidence is junk science. Eye or ear witnesses are notoriously unreliable. People hear and see what they want. My question is, what is or was the most difficult, unexpected thing about representing someone that the public seems to hate?
The public seems to what?
Hate.
Well, I mean, it's you're going to assume that whatever he says or whatever he does is going to be challenged, because that 2.5 weeks of financial crimes was horrendous. And it was very difficult to put him in a sympathetic position. From talking to jurors, there were several jurors who hated him before he ever took the stand, before he ever had a chance to explain his position. So it was difficult, and I don't think obviously we didn't succeed.
The final question from a viewer, do you like Alec Murdoch despite what he's been convicted for?
Do I like him? I mean, I knew Alec not well, but I knew him before all this. He's, you know, an affable guy. He's treated us well. He's not, I mean, I've represented some horrible people. Do I like him? I mean, sure, in the sense that he's done nothing to me or lied to me, that in a way that hurt me. So, no, I mean, is he somebody I'd want to have over to dinner? Probably not. But he's certainly not a bad guy, other than he's a thief, big thief, on drugs. Good people do bad things sometimes. I don't believe he murdered Maggie and Paul.
As far as you know, is he, speaking of the drugs, is he clean in prison?
Oh, that's absolutely. He was clean. He is. We got him into rehab before he was even charged with the murders. And I talked to the doctor down there. He said, worst case of withdrawal he ever seen. He was taking massive amounts of oxy over a period of 7, 8, 9 years. And he got clean. And then once he went to jail, there's no source, steady source of oxy or, and he's in maximum security. So no, he's clean as a whistle.
Yeah. Well, you just heard for an hour, 5 minutes and 55 seconds from arguably, not only in South Carolina, but one of the most recognizable defense attorneys in the entire country, certainly in South Carolina. And Dick Harpootlian, who represented Alec Murdoch, has a new book out, Dig Me a Grave. I assume it's available anywhere books are sold. Dick, I'm going to ask you on camera. I collect some true crime stuff. I would love a signed copy of that book from you. I don't know if you can make it happen.
Let me say this. This is what they call an ARC, as you're familiar with, an advanced review copy. The hard copy will be published on December 16th. And we're going to be doing signings here in Columbia and Charleston, New Orleans, Florence, where Pee-wee was born. And we'll be traveling around the country doing that. I will sign one, Joel, and ship you one. I really appreciate it. And again, if you want a copy of it, you can pre-order on your favorite pre-order site like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and you'll get it on December 16th.
Yeah, I will say this. I'll preach for 1 second. You know, in this day and age, especially with Twitter and all these other things, people are so quick to judge. I mean, I got emails. Why would you even interview that guy? Why? Because you just saw a person with a human side, completely different, to be honest, than what I was expecting in a great way. An open-minded guy. And someone on our show, totally unrelated to this, asked yesterday, how does a criminal defense attorney sleep at night? Well, listen, without criminal defense attorneys, you're in a whole heap of problems if you get yourself in trouble, and it's not that hard to do. So, Dick Harpootlian, thank you for 50 years of service as a solicitor, as a criminal defense attorney, as a politician. We really appreciate you coming on Surviving Survivor.
Well, thank you for having me on. This has been a refreshing discussion, not the typical discussion I have with these podcasts where everybody comes in with a preconception.
Well, I love hearing that. We love you, America. Love you, South Carolina. And let's remember Maggie, Paul, Mallory Beach, and the other victims in this case. And Dick, if you can, hang on one quick second.